Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this White House Open for Questions. I'm Kelly Wallace, chief correspondent of the women's web network, iVillage.com, and I'm really excited to be here with Bruce Reed, who is Vice President Biden's chief of staff. For the next 30 minutes, he'll be taking your questions on what we can do as a country to reduce gun violence. Over the past several days, we've been asking you on Twitter and Facebook and in our iVillage community your questions for Bruce Reed. We'll be asking those, and you also can send us your questions live. You can go to us on Twitter or on Facebook, use the iVillage handle, and also use the hashtag White House Chat, and we'll be asking those questions. Bruce, thank you so much for joining us.
That's great to be here.
And I'll have to wear my glasses, a sign of age. Bruce, you know, the first question we have is from a mom who has a children at Sandy Hook Elementary School. She does some work for us at iVillage. Her name is Sarah. And she said that in talking about gun control, it's clear that anything the country does will impact future gun sales, but what about the existing owners and weapons? What about all those guns and all the ammunition that has been purchased legally that won't be under the new laws? Well, what will we do about that?
That's a great question, Sarah, and I'm sorry for everything that you and the community have gone through. It has been a wrenching experience, I know, for you, and the Vice President and I have met with a number of families of the victims and some survivors as well. And the tragedy in Newtown has seared the conscience of the nation and forced us all to look at these questions in a way that we would have liked to have done much sooner. So our general attitude is as the president put it, even if we only save one life, even if we only save 1,000 lives out of this, every step, additional step we take is a good one, and that we shouldn't make the perfect the enemy of the good. It would be a wonderful thing for the country if we could put a limitation on all multi-round, high-capacity ammunition clips like those that were used in Newtown and elsewhere, including the existing ones, but it's just not practical to do that. So we're going to try to make sure that for assault weapons, for ammunition clips, for background checks, that we're at least keeping the country from making the same mistake over and over again, and that we that the next criminal that tries to go and buy a gun at a gun show isn't able to do so, and that the next person who's thinking about committing a mass act of atrocity can't go buy an assault weapon or a 33-round ammunition clip.
You know, Bruce, this is a question. We get this from Pat, who's from Pittsburgh, and it really is a sentiment we hear a lot of, you hear a lot of. And he says that his family has guns, they hunt, they're generally very responsible, and the knee-jerk reaction he's hearing from relatives is, quote, "No one is taking my gun." And he said these are sane, seemingly rational, normal people who feel like their right to bear arms is going to be revoked. What can you say? Can you give a simple explanation to what gun control will mean to Pat's family and other people around the country who feel like they do?
Well, I understand completely how they feel. I come from gun country myself. I grew up with guns. I'm from northern Idaho. This isn't about taking anyone's gun away. We are just trying to make the law work. Right now, it's against the law for a criminal to, a felon, fugitive, someone who's been convicted of domestic violence. It's against the law for them to own a gun. And yet, we have a system that allows them to go and buy a gun in a lot of places, at gun shows, in parking lots, in unregulated sales. So our view is that if every gun owner grew up with the kind of tradition of responsible gun ownership that hunters and sportsmen and people who love guns do, then we wouldn't have this problem. But that's, you know, that unfortunately is not the case. We have one of the things we need to do is crack down on illegal gun trafficking, where people, a person who can legally buy a gun goes and does so, and then turns around and sells it to a criminal. There's a lot more we can do to strengthen the laws to prevent that from happening. But this, you can love guns and love the president's package of recommendations here, because it isn't about restricting anyone's Second Amendment rights.
We got this question again. You know, we're picking some of the questions that tap into what other women in our community are talking about. Allison from New Jersey, she says, I believe in stricter gun laws with an emphasis on background checks, but how can you ensure that someone with a mental health issue cannot get a permit, cannot buy a gun? If they're not forthcoming and there's this doctor-patient confidentiality, how can this be done?
The way the law works is if you have been adjudicated through a legal process as having the term of art is adjudicated mental defective, which basically means you've been committed, that makes you ineligible to buy a gun. One problem with the current system is that a number of states have not submitted their records to the national background check system. And there are 17 states that have submitted 10 records or less. We know that the number that should be in the system are much greater than that. Pennsylvania alone has about 600,000 records that they put into the system. So the first step that we should take is to make sure that everybody who is already legally barred from, or should be legally barred from owning a gun because of a mental illness, is in that system. There's a lot more that we can do, and frankly, a lot of it is in the prevention end. One of the great opportunities that we have here as a country is to take mental illness prevention and treatment much more seriously. You know, the healthcare law that the president enacted in his first term will dramatically increase the availability of mental health services. There are an estimated 6 to 10 million people with mental illness who will now have access to healthcare, which is a great thing. And then we're also going to be carrying out the law to make sure that insurers treat mental health, provide mental health services to the same level that they provide physical health.
And we just got this question in on Facebook, Courtney from New York, who says, let's say all of the White House's proposed gun legislation passes. How quickly do you think we would start to see real change in the level of violence? Months? Years? What would you say?
Well, to give you a set, it's impossible to make that kind of prediction, but I've been working on this issue for 20 years. When we passed the Brady Bill in 1993, so nearly 20 years ago, over the course of that time, over the 20 years that we've been doing background checks, we've seen a significant, an enormous drop, really, in violent crime and in gun-related crime. Not all that is because of the background check system. We did a bunch of other things. We put a lot more police on the street. Police departments got better. Other things changed in the society. But we have seen deaths by murder, firearm-related murders drop by about a third over that 20-year period. So we can make real headway on a host of fronts relatively quickly. It's not, we don't have a solution to every aspect of this. We're not pretending that we do, but there are some fairly simple things that would make a real difference.
We got this question from Sharon, who's out in Bedford Corners, New York, about school security, something that's at the heart, close to lots of parents' heart, like my own. Do you believe that schools should be patrolled internally and externally by armed guards? Because that's what school districts, she says, are now talking about and what citizens are demanding. But the very idea of more guns around children, even if they are in the holster of a trained security guard, makes me cringe, she says. How long until we have our first case of a mistaken shooting of an innocent person or child? How do you respond to that?
Well, as the president put it, we don't think that the answer to gun violence in schools is more guns in schools. It's entirely up to local communities how best to keep their community safe, how best to keep their schools safe. We can do a lot to make sure they have the resources to do so. And in a lot of cases, school resource officers who are sometimes armed, sometimes not, who are authority figures who work in schools can do a lot of good, totally unrelated to gun violence. But that's a decision for the communities to make on their own. We think it's a bad idea to put an armed guard in to dictate from Washington that there ought to be an armed guard in every school. What we've proposed is that the federal government should help schools find the best way to do this. We're putting forward enough resources to help school districts hire 1,000 school resource officers, or if they prefer, school counselors, school psychologists, all of whom are primarily there for spotting trouble before it happens. You know, if your whole prevention program is when the gunman is at the door, it's too late. You need to we need to make sure that we're seeing trouble as it emerges, and that every grown-up in that situation is part of the solution.
Another question that's just come in on Twitter, this from Dina in New Jersey. And again, I know you talk about wanting to let the states decide some of these issues, but I'm wondering about your personal feelings about what would you say to teachers, assuming they've been trained, who want to carry a concealed gun at school? Maybe approach it as a father, and also he's approach it as someone who's worked on this issue for many years. Do you have concerns about that?
Well, the different states approach this in different ways. One good thing that states that do concealed weapons systems permits do is that they do a criminal background check on everybody. They take an extra measure of making sure that it varies from state. Some states do an excellent job of teaching people gun safety and so on. In other states, it's really not as rigorous as you'd want it to be. In general, I come back to what the president said, that look at how much we are asking teachers to do already. Simply teaching our young people is hard enough. It shouldn't fall to them to be responsible for the physical safety of the kids that they're teaching, or of the building that they're teaching in, and you know, it varies from community to community what the best answer is. Some schools are in tough neighborhoods with a lot of crime going on nearby. In other places, not so much. And the truth of the matter is that even in some of our more dangerous places, the school is usually the safest part of America. So, where kids are really in danger in some of the tougher spots is walking to and from school. That's where that that lovely young woman who was gunned down in Chicago, the one who had performed in the inaugural parade, she was killed outside of school, and that happens far more frequently. So, if you're a parent and you're, you know, all of us as parents worry about our how our kids are doing at school and whether they're safe at school. And it's good to worry. That's what we do as parents. But you should know that in general, your kids are in good hands and in safe places when they're at school. There's a lot of other trouble in the world that that we have a responsibility to work on, and. You know, one of the things that the president has proposed to help communities that have real crime problems is to dramatically increase the number of police on the street, to provide communities that have been having to lay off police officers because of budget cuts, some federal help to make sure that in areas with a big gang problem, in areas with a big crime, gun violence problem, that they have enough men and women in blue on the street.
To follow to that, on Twitter, we received something from a question from Earth Rift, who said, if gun control worked, Chicago would not have had more than 500 murders last year. Time to target gangs, not guns. Something you hear from people that not you know, focus more on the gang violence, not on the guns.
It's interesting because I've been doing crime policy for a couple decades, and the real breakthrough when we started to make headway as a country in reducing crime and violent crime is when we stopped having these either-or debates. So in the 80s, there was a long-running debate about, yeah, you should go after the guns. Other people said, no, you should have longer sentences. Some said you should go after gangs. Some said you should have more cops. And we decided, look, crime is an important enough problem. does enough damage to both economically and socially to our society, we should just throw the book at it, try everything we can, see what works. And I feel the same way about this. It's not that that some gun laws are going to change everything, that suddenly evil will disappear from the world. Far from it. You need to go after the gangs. You need to go and make sure that gangs and other criminals can't buy guns. You need to make sure that there are police on the street who are there stopping things that we can't even anticipate happening. So with respect to Chicago, you know, Chicago's an example of Chicago, the city has strong laws, but it's surrounded by suburbs and a state that have much looser laws. So if you're a gang member in Chicago, you can go to a gun store in the suburbs, have a friend or girlfriend buy a gun from a gun store, that person is legally able to buy a gun. They can turn around, sell it to you, and then you can go back into the city of Chicago and wreak all kinds of mayhem with that gun. So guns are the kind of problem that if the national system has a bunch of holes, like if the national background check system is just Swiss cheese, then criminals will find their way into it. And one of the reasons that we want background checks for every sale is to prevent that, to say, if you're a criminal, we all agree as a country you shouldn't have your hands on a gun, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun. So let's have a common sense system that makes it as hard as possible for you to do that.
I got a question from Amanda in Frederick, Maryland, who said that she's curious about how closely the federal government is working with the states to help them develop and implement their own plans when it comes to reducing gun violence, and if you're providing, the government's providing any incentives, maybe financial incentives or other incentives, to help them with their plans.
We're getting a lot of cooperation, and we're working closely with the states. The vice president, my boss, has had a number of conversations with governors about this issue. The greatest area of cooperation is we run this background check system together. Federal government oversees the background check, but the records for that come from local police records, state police records, state mental health records, federal law enforcement records. Those all go into some national databases, and so when you go to Dick's Sporting Goods to buy a hunting rifle, and you tell them your name and address or social security number or whatever identifying data that they ask for, it runs a very quick instant check on whether you turn up in any of these criminal databases. That system is a fabulous way to stop a criminal from buying a gun, in the same way that, you know, that credit card companies make sure that if you're a deadbeat, you can't use that credit card. But it depends entirely on the quality of the data that everybody's putting in. So every state needs to make sure that its law enforcement records are automated and that they get into the system, and the same with local communities, and the same with federal agencies. And so that's taken it's taken a number of years to get it as strong as it is now. We still need to do a lot more, but over the last 15 years we've been able to prevent 2 million guns from being sold to felons, fugitives, and others who are prohibited from purchasing them.
Alice, who just wrote in on Twitter, she said, after the tragedy in Newtown, is right now the best chance we've ever had for meaningful new legislation?
Well, I think it has. This tragedy has put a face on the problem and has made it very difficult for anyone on without respect to party to walk away from it. It's it will be a haunting memory for a long, long time, and not just for the community and not just for the families involved. So so it has it has a great opportunity for us to have a far-reaching conversation, not just about guns, but also about mental health and about school safety and some other issues that have been raised by this. So I think we have a good chance. I think that you've seen the sort of overwhelming response across party lines the proposal for background checks for all has the support of 90% of Americans, including 90% of gun owners.
Right, I'll put my political cap on since I used to cover this building, right? But some of the other proposals, banning assault weapons and the high magazine, you know, high capacity magazine clips, you don't have, you know, tremendous support. You have some sentiment even from, you know, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid that they're going to just take up what they can get through in the House. So, you know, some people say that that is really, even in light of Newtown, not likely to happen.
Some of these are harder than others. Almost everything I think that we've proposed has majority support around the country, and even the more controversial issues like the assault weapons ban have strong majority support. You know, close to three-fifths to two-thirds of the country are for them. The problem for the politicians, the elected officials, is that traditionally the voices of those who oppose measures like that have been louder and easier to hear than the voices of supporters. But you know, the very conversation we're having right now is testament to why that is changing. That 20 years ago, when we passed the assault weapons ban the first time, the gun lobby was extraordinarily well organized. It had a great grassroots network of people to complain and raise objections to what we were trying to do. The internet had barely been created. There was no Facebook. We didn't have Twitter. There's so much more that individuals can do now to make their voices heard to their leaders. And as the president said, has said on a number of occasions, it's really up to you. Instead of Washington throwing up its hands and saying, "Well, here's another problem we can't solve because the country's with us, but we don't hear them," you know, make your voices known. You can make a world of difference back here. And I think the other reason that something should happen here is that I think most people, without respect to party, really do want to do something to make sure that this kind of tragedy doesn't happen again. And, you know, we may have differences about what we should do first, what will make the most difference, but I think everyone across the spectrum would have a hard time letting this one just fall by the wayside.
We have Wendy from Chicago who just wrote in on Facebook, "What will be the national role of mentoring programs in reducing gun violence?" And I even found, right when the Newtown tragedy happened, even as I was blogging about guns, so many people quickly said, and rightfully so, there's so much more in the mix. There's mental health, there's, you know, education, and, you know, the issue of mentoring and doing more to help our young people.
Well, there's an awful lot that we can and should and need to do to help young people. Some of it's related to gun violence. Some of it we don't really know exactly what connection it may have, but we know that we have to do better by kids. The president announced in the State of the Union, for example, that he thinks it's time for the country to have universal preschool because kids, if they start out school behind, they're going to stay behind. We've been supportive of after-school programs and of mentoring programs as ways to make sure that kids and young people have something to do during the day if their parents are working, and to make sure that adults are engaged in young people's lives. You do see that in a number of these cases where kids have been, or young people have been, sending out trouble distress signals, and just no adult was there to quite interpret or respond to them. So it isn't just up to government to solve this problem. There's a role for every family, every parent, every community, every church to pay attention to the young people who have, you know, that period between ages of 16 and 25 is the real danger zone for where young people are most likely to have undiagnosed problems, or they'll know they have a problem, but they don't know what to do, or their they're afraid to come forward and ask for help. And so, you know, there's parents are a heck of a lot more powerful than government in the lives of our young people. We need to make sure the government does its part. But in the end, parents are going to make an enormous difference.
Yeah, and speaking of parents, this is a very interesting question, Liz from New York City. What do we teach kids about guns moving forward? Is this something that should be discussed at school? Now, I know you're not going to sit here and say what the federal government expects to be done in schools, but I'm just wondering, as a policy person, as a father?
I think it's always good. Well, certainly, when there's a national tragedy like this, it's important to sit down and talk with, for parents to talk to their kids. It's in my view, completely understandable to talk about it at school, to reassure kids that they're safe, talk about why something like this might happen. Not to have a political discussion of what to do about it, but just so that young people can understand. And then I do think that there's a legitimate gun culture out there. I grew up in it when I was, you know, 12 years old. Everybody in traipsed on down to the shooting range. We took the NRA hunter safety course, and we saw a film about the dangers of going hunting and not paying attention to what you were doing with. We learned that guns were scary things. And that's all to the good. I think there's it's important for kids to grow up with a more well-rounded view of this whole problem than just what they might see in a video game or what they might see in a movie. That, you know, that I think everybody across the spectrum agrees that guns are dangerous. They need to be treated with respect. They need to be locked up when they're and kept unloaded when they're not in use. That, you know, that they're for grown-ups. They're not for kids, and that's an important discussion now.
You know, and this question from Rich in Monroe, New York. Again, a sentiment you're hearing across the country. We're hearing it a little bit in the iVillage community. Criminals who are responsible for most crimes do not buy weapons from the store. They don't hold the permits. The only person this law is going to hurt and make a difference against is the hardworking, law-abiding citizens. It goes back to sort of that comment, you know, from Pat in Pennsylvania. But that's a sentiment, you know, where many people feel that the gun legislation that's being proposed is not going to impact the criminals who are getting the guns illegally, just the law-abiding citizens. How do you respond
to
that?
Well, I remember people said that about the background checks when we first set them up, that this was going to impinge on the rights of law-abiding people. And it's no trouble at all. That's like saying that, you know, it impinges on the rights of law-abiding citizens to run a credit card check when you buy something at the store. It's just a common sense thing to make sure it's the easiest, least intrusive way of making sure that the whole system works. As I said earlier, 2 million people who are felons, fugitives, criminals, convicted of domestic violence felonies have tried to buy a gun, gone through the background check system, and been denied a gun because of that. 2 million over the last 15 years. So criminals are going to try to get guns the easiest way they can. We shouldn't make going to the store, going to the gun show, going to a flea market an easy way to get a gun. We should make it as hard as possible for people who want to break the law to have the opportunity to do so.
You know, the president has said we should make it as easy to get access to mental health care as it is in this country to get access to a gun. And speaking of that, we have Beth from Chicago who asks, what new steps are being taken to address mental health in teens? I wonder if there's anything the government is doing right now in response to Newtown before it needs any legislative approval that is going to impact teens and access to mental health.
Yeah, there are a couple things that we're doing. Secretary Kathleen Sebelius from the Health and Human Services Department has been advocating and helping states and communities figure out ways to teach mental health first aid. It's just like first aid for first responders on the physical side, but to spot the trouble signs. That's one of the best things that we can do, is make sure that adults who are around kids know what to look for and know what to do about it.
Lemmy, I think we're going to make this our last question. It's been such a great, robust discussion. This is going to be the last question, and it's going to be, can you give us some more info on what are the warning signs that kids have but can't talk about?
Oh, well, that's a, you know, that's a long list. It varies by kid. I think that the good news is every young person is different, but usually, as I said earlier, kids are giving off distress signals. So, it's important for adults to see it, but their peers can see it too. If they look on their Facebook pages, you see in every one of these instances, or many of these instances, when police go back and look at the Facebook page of the shooter, there are plenty of signs that maybe there's a problem going on. So it's a responsibility of teachers to, they know which kids are adjusting well to the situation and which ones aren't. Often the real problem is they're not quite sure what to do. You know, the teacher thinks, well, it's not really my responsibility. So it's important for schools to have protocols that that the teacher tells the school counselor, school counselor tells the parent. It varies by state, from state by state, whether who can refer to a doctor. And as the kids get older, it gets more challenging. But the main thing is people should be. We need to get to a level of recognition that we see that the mental problems and the physical problems aren't that different. And that if you saw someone who was in your class and they were bleeding from their upper lip, you wouldn't ignore it. You'd point it out to them or to someone else. You'd make sure that it got treated in some way. And mental issues are harder to spot, but not impossible, even more important to treat.
Okay, 1 to 10. 10 is 100% optimistic. 1 is entirely pessimistic. We will see some sort of legislative change when it comes to guns following Newtown.
I think you never want to overestimate the odds of quick action in Washington, but I'm really optimistic that this time is different, that the country's going to get its way, and that we're going to get something done this year.
Okay, Bruce Reed, thank you so much
for
joining us. We really appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, Bruce Reed, Vice President Biden's Chief of Staff, who has been on the front lines, really, of this gun control discussion over the past several months. I'm Kelly Wallace, Chief Correspondent with iVillage. We want to let you know that this entire Open for Questions with Bruce Reed will be available later today on whitehouse.gov and iVillage.com. Thanks again for your questions and for joining us. Have a great day.